Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask that of all my prayer. I just like the sound.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Ethel, baby mammy. Fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1989. Fucking up a broom closet here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Felisco.
I wasn't going to say fucking up, but it just kind of came out that way.
It's Turner Nugent. Today, drop the F-bombs. Come on.
Yeah, that's right. With us today, Toby Herman is back to talk about Flick. Thank you for coming on, Toby.
Oh my God. Thank you for having me. This is the most exciting thing to happen about 1989. Besides my bat mitzvah and the Taylor Swift album.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there you
That's
go.
True. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Besides my bat mitzvah. One, two. Phil, I think Phil would have Taylor Swift
I
album.
I might have Taylor above
Toby's bat mitzvah. But,
I mean, you know.
But is that we never talk about 1989, the Taylor Swift album. It is my favorite Taylor Swift album. I know it's
interesting.
Not Phil's favorite Taylor Swift album.
It's not my Taylor.
But well, Kenny, I really do love it.
When you want to go there, you have my number.
do you love it or do you not love it?
Oh, I love it.
I think it has some incredible songs on that album.
I think it's
I don't mean to suggest I don't like it.
It's delicious.
Hmm? Yeah. I love it. It's just not my favorite Taylor Swift.
No, I figured you didn't dislike it. Yeah. But this is not about Taylor Swift's album, it's 1989. Not. It is about the films of 1989.
Correct.
Including Turner and Hooch, a movie I would not have guaranteed we would have covered at the beginning of this.
You know, it's funny. Kenny and I put together a list, like sort of the, like, you know, the 1989 list that you would imagine, right? Mm. And then it kind of kept growing because there were these other movies that we were like, but wait, this would be fun to do as well. And I liked this movie as
a kid. Many good movies in 1989. I mean, like, I think Phil and I kind of feel like that at least the top tier, the top tier seems a little stronger than even 99. There might be more better movies in 99, but like these really, really top movies are really strong. But Turner and Hooch is an interesting one. I thought Turner and Hooch sucked, and I think I'm wrong. I think Turner and Hooch is awesome. So, like, I you don't like it, Toby?
I didn't say that.
You rolled your eyes. And your neck. So
Toby and I were texting about this a little bit because I was sensing a little bit of shade, let's say, about
what's going on, Toby.
And then I also was like, I had to be clear with her that it occurred to me as I watched this film the other day that I saw this film a lot as a kid, but like kind of put it away in the back of my head. It just wasn't a movie that I ever really thought about. And then within 5 minutes, I was like, oh, I know every beat of this movie. I've seen this movie a lot. And I've got a soft spot for this movie. I don't think it's a great movie, but I think it's I think it's got a lot of good shit in it. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I'm a sucker for Hooch.
I'm not touching that. So I understand having deep feelings for a movie that is not technically good. Like I mm-hmm. have probably seen Leap Year more than the people who actually produced the movie. I understand what that feels like. And a lot of the movies that I am either nostalgic for or hold very, very like strong feelings sure. about are not necessarily good.
Yeah.
Regardless, this is not one of them.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
All right. So let's recalibrate because okay. I assumed you liked this movie because you chose this movie. Did you not choose this movie?
Sent her the list of the movies that were available. And she came back to me, and Turner and Hooch was one of the films.
Okay. So that's a reasonable way to get here.
I mean, I saw it in the theater growing up. I remember it. And, I mean, it's Tom Hanks. I wanted to revisit it. So it's not like there's no gun to my head.
I thought it was the opposite. I thought you put the gun to our head. So, all right. So now I have to kind of, like, recalibrate my thinking.
Sure.
I very rarely – in this podcast, I think, am the person who is championing a movie where I think Phil sounds like he's, you know, half good. You know, he's more or less, you know, center right into it. Mm-hmm. And Toby, it sounds like you hate it.
No, that's just me. No, I don't hate it. I have feelings and thoughts, but I don't hate it.
All right.
Can I ask a question? Can mm-hmm. I ask a question, Toby?
Yeah. I think
I think that this movie is trying to do a lot of things, and it's trying to do two things. One, I would say it does slightly better than the other. I don't think that the romantic storyline of this movie is I enjoy Tom Hanks and Mare Winningham. I think they're quite charming together and they have a nice chemistry. I was very happy to see them come together again for News of the World, which I saw recently, and they're in that. So that was a nice reunion. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't think that she's really given much to do necessarily.
Agreed.
And I'm wondering if part of, and it's completely fair, that part of your maybe frustrations with this film have to do with the fact that it's a pretty masculine movie.
The romance is my favorite thing in the movie.
Let's get this all out on the table. I don't want to keep guessing, Toby.
Yeah.
What are your feelings about this film?
Yeah. Bring it.
Overall, I think it's a very confused movie. I think there were like 42 writers or something like that.
Well, we'll talk about the writing credits.
Yeah. It is halfway through the movie before we get a decent scene. And then there's this like fantastic rom-com-esque, like almost, dare I say, Nora Ephron-ish monologue that I'm like, oh, now you have me. Now I'm into this movie. Now it's actually good for a minute. So let's keep going on this track. It's like they switched the entire, I was going to say writer's room. It's a movie. It doesn't have a room, but it kind of did. It had so many writers. I feel like they switched the entire production staff halfway through. Like they just cleared out and it became a completely separate movie halfway through.
Well, so let's just talk for a quick second. You brought up the writers, so we should talk about this for a second. Mm-hmm. There are five writers, two teams, and a solo writer, Dennis Chirac and Michael Blodgett, Daniel Petrie Jr. and Jim Cash and Jack Epps Jr. Petrie, Cash, Epps.
Oh, I know where you're going,
guys. Yeah. So what you have is Petri does Beverly Hills Cop, Cash and Epps wrote Top Gun. I don't know, unfortunately, the credits of the earlier team. And I think it feels, to your point, and I agree with you, that there is a sort of schizophrenic component to it. Like the crime stuff is kind of Beverly Hills Copy in mm-hmm. a way. And I don't mean that in a bad way. And then I think that the Mayor Winningham stuff, I don't know who wrote that, obviously, but it feels like a different movie. Mm-hmm. And it feels like Hanks locks into that stuff in a way that he doesn't really lock into the crime stuff. But I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I'm still even wrestling with how to approach this podcast.
I didn't mean to blindside you.
Oh, it's okay. No. That's fine. This is great. So I'll give you my history with Turner and Hooch. Mm-hmm. It's very limited. I truly saw Turner and Hooch once in my life before this on an airplane about 30 years ago. So this is what I remember about Turner and Hooch. Finding it a very stressful and secondhand embarrassing watch on an airplane with other people, because I find the slobber to be so incredibly revolting. And to sit on an airplane with 100 strangers and feeling almost as if I have to carry the burden of this movie, because it's clearly aimed towards 9-year-olds, you know, like little 9-year-olds who love guns and gross out humor. I found that very stressful. Now, I've always associated Turner and Hooch in my head with that feeling of like the slobber. All I ever remembered was the slobber going into this. And
it's hard to forget.
And also what I consider to be a pretty stupid premise, right? Like ultimately, like I just remember thinking like Turner and Hooch is like it's a joke premise, and it's a stain and an embarrassment on Tom Hanks's career. So I came into it with very low expectations. Sure. Like I have great respect for Toby. So I thought maybe this is pretty good if Toby wants to do it, but I did not even want to do this movie because it's embarrassing to even put it on our Twitter feed.
I think the most upsetting thing about that is that you have a lot of respect for me. Like I want to,
We have tons of respect for you, Toby.
I have a lot of respect for you as a human, but you also you rode so hard for Walk on the Moon, which
turned me around on that.
Phil and I talk about a lot. Like we really love that movie. Mm-hmm. And that's not an easy thing to do. I mean, we do get turned around here and there, but we only get turned around by people we respect. We've had some guests recently that I don't really respect that much. So just kidding. I'm just joking. This is Patreon. Don't worry.
Don't worry. No one's paying for this.
So what I wanted to say is, and this is not the best way to look at it. This is why I'm recalibrating in the moment is how serious are you guys taking this film? Because I feel like you're almost approaching it like it's meant to be taken seriously, which it might be. But 32 years later, I'm taking it really not seriously and pleasantly surprised that there is, to me, a workable plot and a somewhat compelling plot. I found the chemistry between Turner and Hooch to be really fucking charming. I thought the Mayor Winningham stuff was really charming. And I absolutely love young Tom Hanks. I love old Tom Hanks, but young Tom Hanks brings something to the party that we don't get very often. And it's a real treat. I honestly found it to be a treat watching this film.
So I just want to preemptively just say something here. And I obviously very much want to hear what you have to say, Toby. But the reason that this got put on the list, or quite frankly, I put this on the list, was because we have two Tom Hanks movies in 89. We have this and we have The Burbs. And it is a bit of a fulcrum point in Hanks's career. Shortly thereafter, we get, this is kind of a brutal movie for him in the sense that it's not a movie that's particularly respected. He then walks into a thrasher for Bonfire of the Vanities. And that's kind of the low point of can I even rebound from this? He does League of Their Own, and we obviously know where he goes from there. But I put it on here because I felt like it's a fun movie and I wanted to see it up against or next to The Burbs and Joe versus the Volcano, which are all kind of clumped together. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about. We wouldn't have done it, quite frankly, unless someone, if I gave the list to someone and someone picked it. And because Toby picked it with other films, just to be clear, Toby didn't say like just Turner and Hooch with a bullet. Like she obviously wanted other films. But she picked Turner and Hooch and I was like, you know, I love Toby. I'm sure we'll be able to have a great conversation about this film. I'm not taking it particularly seriously. I watched this film. Kenny, I imagine you mentioned you watched it with your kids. I imagine your kids loved it, right?
Who loved it? Now we're a dog family, but like I thought like it would be an insult to call my kids Hooch. And my daughter has requested I refer to her as Hooch now. She loves Hooch so much.
That's so fantastic.
Yeah. And but, my kids are eight. Yeah. My kids are the exact age I would have been when I watched it when I was a kid. And I guess, you know, I guess they're just more evolved than me. They don't find the bodily functions of another living creature to be disgusting the way I do.
Can I I'm going to say one other thing, and I'm sorry. This is a bit of a tangent, but I got to do it. I'm watching... I thought of you last night, Kenny, because of how repulsed you are, I know, by cheese.
Yeah, disgusting.
And finds cheese disgusting. And that's fine. That's your prerogative. I watched the Stanley Tucci. I watched the Stanley Tucci CNN show that he has where he's going to Italy. I don't know if you guys have heard about this. You should watch it. It's great.
I mean, I watch CNN and they put ads on every 3 seconds.
Right. So, okay, sure. So I say all this because he goes to the place where they make buffalo mozzarella. And watching them churn it, and I literally was like, Kenny wouldn't be able to watch this. So that's all I have to say about that. I'm sorry, Kenny, but my
daughter today made her own Caesar salad dressing.
Oh yeah,
how you can imagine?
She's eight. I mean, she's the coolest, and she's Hooch. But she made her own. My wife and I, neither of us eat mustard or mayonnaise. So and my son doesn't eat it. My other kids don't eat it. My daughter just has jumped into all these, you know, dressings and sauces and now is like experimenting. So she basically made a mustard salad tonight. I was ready to jump off the roof. So it's like, all right.
Toby,
welcome to the podcast.
Hi, guys.
Do you remember when you saw this film for the first time? Was it 2 days ago?
No, briefly. I mean, that's not the right word. I know I saw it in the theater. I kind of lump it together in my head with like Dragnet and Adventures in Babysitting and just these
Big? Is that another one? Big?
Big left a huge impression on me. And I look at that as like an elevated performance comparatively. Yeah, yeah. But to me, this is like a summer fun movie. Like not quite Goonies by any means, but you know, just one of those, you know, you go and you see it in the summer. So of course, now you tell me probably it came out in like February or something, right?
No, it came out July 28th, right in the summer.
There you go. So I remember seeing it. I don't know that I've seen it since. Going into it, I thought I would have more nostalgic feelings for it. I thought I would like fall back into it for the same reasons that you were mentioning, Phil. And I didn't like, I truly didn't hate it. And I understand its place in our lives, but I just think the movie is so confused. And this isn't holding it up against, you know, the best films that have ever been made. I just think the movie doesn't know what it is. And as me now, I bumped on that.
Did you feel the so the director was originally Henry Winkler?
Oh, yes.
And then Henry Winkler left, departed, was fired, depending on how you, I don't know. I'm sure we can dig into this some more because I know that him and Hanks didn't get along. I think his words were
fucking crazy.
Is that not crazy?
This is my favorite thing about the entire movie.
Please.
The two nicest men in Hollywood fucking hated each other. So
that is
Henry Winkler,
bad.
This is amazing. Henry Winkler was on the shoot for 13 days, I believe, and then he left. A few years ago, he was on Watch What Happens Live with Andy Cohen, and he had a call asking him about the film, and he basically summed it up that he got along better with Hooch than Turner. And then I did a little bit of a deep dive. Ron Howard happens to hold a significant place in both Tom and Henry's lives. And apparently both men sought out Ron's advice and like leaned on him after this, because they were also kind of, it seems like they were also kind of like, how is this happening? This is so unfortunate. But also, we can't work together. It's so insane to me. It's like catnip. Crazy. I love it. I want more.
I know Henry fairly well because my kids are very close with his grandkids, and I have spent like a lot of time with him. I like at his house and Jewish holidays and whatever. Like we've got. Like,
I love that for you.
That was
genuine. Like that makes me very happy.
Let me tell you about Henry Winkler. So there are three kids in that family. And we were like, you know, we were in like that group of friends where like, if like the little kids have a birthday, my twins get invited. Right. So one of the little kids had a birthday and it's three boys, a very boy themed birthday party. And my daughter, cause I have twins, right? 8-year-old twins. My daughter's like basically the only girl there. And she doesn't want to get involved. So she's kind of sitting off to the side. Henry takes her hand, sits down with her in front of a plate of crudité, and they go through each piece together, dipping into the different dressings, all the things that I find revolting, and going and talking. And she's like fucking 5 at the time and talking through all of these vegetables, like giving her his undivided attention. He is a prince. Like I cannot overstate it. The man sweats nice beads. Like the idea that anybody would not get along with him is lunacy.
Like he's the mensch of menches, right?
Everyone was so happy when he won the Emmy for Barry because they were just like Henry Winkler is having like a renaissance. Like But I do wonder whether or not they bring in another director. Roger Spottiswood takes over for him. I looked at his credits. He did do a Bond movie. He did Tomorrow Never Dies, which is a fine Bond movie. It's not a great Bond movie, but I actually think that this film on a technical level, and I'm not, again, like I'm not taking this movie seriously, but on a technical level, it's pretty well shot. It understands its tone. It's pretty pedestrian, but I do think it understands the Hanks and the dog shit. Like, I think it understands that. And I think that the impression I get is that he kind of let Tom and Mare do what they were going to do in their scenes. Like, they're not really directed. Like, they're just kind of allowed to just sort of do whatever comes naturally to them. But I do think that the dog stuff works pretty well. Like, I mean, I don't know how to say it other than I think that it's a shtick for sure. But if someone came into if I was an executive and someone pitched to me, it's Tom Hanks. He's an uptight detective and he's got a crazy dog. I mean, I'd probably buy that. Like, it's not like, wouldn't you?
He wasn't Tom Hanks then though, in the same way. And he was to be, I mean, he had been, was it Uncle Ned on Family Ties?
No, hold on. You're not giving him. He had done big before this.
Done big. He was nominated for Best Actor the year before. Like this guy. The crazy thing is that he did this stupid fucking dog movie.
That is the thing to me.
And like, I would not have greenlit it because it's a stupid dog movie. And life is too short. And it doesn't matter if you make back your budget. You have to tell people you know that you made the dog movie, which is embarrassing. Okay, so I think that everything that I like read about this, it all surprised me so much. Like, this was the biggest spec sale in history. Like, who reads the show? Who reads the movie that's like, it's Jim Belushi's Canine, but with a ugly dog? And they decided to pay the most money ever for a script. I don't feel that way at all, Phil. I don't feel like this is a slam dunk. I feel like most of the time, this is a failure, the man and with the silly man and dog movie, or if it's a success, it's like the most embarrassing thing this person does, like Clint Eastwood's Anyway, you know, Any Which Way But Loose.
That's the monkey movie, right? That's when he did the monkey.
He did two, and it's the monkey movie. And this, you know the way I feel about Clint Eastwood, like, and I literally have his fucking biography sitting on my desk. But he did this. It's just this humiliating blight on his career. So I go ahead.
Yes, Toby.
No, I was going to say I agree with most of that. The biggest thing that I learned in my research, when they were trying to convince Tom Hanks to do Toy Story, they showed him, they used the voice from the scene when he's in the car on the stakeout with Hooch.
Yeah.
And he's like, don't eat the car, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Knowing that and then watching it, you hear Woody. Like,
I heard Woody through this whole movie. 100%. So much Woody. Crazy.
And like when Woody's just like losing his temper and everything like that, like that's exactly what it is. So,
and Woody's uptight. You know what I mean? Like that's part of it too. Like part of Woody's thing is that he can't like let go of stuff. So like there's a lot of Woody in this performance for sure.
So for that reason, if Turner and Hooch has to exist to give us Toy Story,
that's worth it.
You know, the other discovery that I made, I don't know if I really want this like recorded, but I'm just going to go for it anyway. Tom Hanks is in his underwear for a lot of this movie, like inexplicably.
Yeah.
He's kind of fit. And
were you hot? Were you horny for Tom Hanks in this movie?
Were
you? I mean, he's wearing very tight black little underwear, right? Is that a good way to describe it?
They're also
I want to ask it with a little more, you know,
tact?
Toothness.
Yeah, sorry. My apologies. I didn't mean
to. Tom Hanks hot? Like, just in general.
So, to me, he's a dad when dads were gross. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was, like, that much older where it was just, like, he's just a parent. Like, that's just the
age
he felt when I was younger. Yes. I thought he was endearing, borderline adorable in some things, but again, I never crushed on him. He was never in that same conversation. I'm trying to think, like, I mean, Tom Cruise is a complicated figure, but like he was the one on the magazines, not Tom Hanks, right? And so I never really considered Tom Hanks as like hot, or I never considered how he looked.
I want to talk
of like what his hottest, role is. Is this hot? His hottest role?
No, there's one movie he was like hot in, very problematic movie these days, but all days, I guess. He is hot in Bachelor Party. Like so
bad
hot,
hair, but yeah.
So he's so cool in that movie. Like every move he makes is so balls to the wall. There's just something so like gonzo about that performance that there's a different trajectory Tom Hanks could have gone down that would have been more hot guy. But like, is Tom Hanks like, it's a weird thing to have this guy who is a romantic lead. Some of his most iconic roles are romantic leads, right? Mm-hmm. Part of our Tracy and Hepburn, you know, who's more Tracy and Hepburn in the last 50 years than him and Meg Ryan? Are there people? So we have like that thing, right? He obviously, there is a segment that buys him as someone worthy of like having, you know, being crushed on.
Yeah.
So there's that thing. The weird thing about this movie, and I actually do think this is like super relevant, is like, yeah, he's objectified through so much of this film. Like he doesn't have, no one else would necessarily do that. There's nothing weird about sleeping in a t-shirt. So like he could have been in long pants. A decision was made that Tom Hanks is looking good and we should put you, Tom Hanks, Academy Award nominee, in your underwear in this dog movie throughout because people want it. That's interesting to me.
Okay. Yes, and one of the strangest moments for me, and like I said, the romance was my buy-in for the movie more than anything at this age. One of the strangest things after he and Mayor Winningham spend the night together, they're in the kitchen and he's got his shirt off, you know, and she comes in and she's wearing a robe and whatever. He's wearing jeans. Like, it makes no sense to me. I don't
never understand. Nude.
What?
He's a never nude.
No, but I mean, you're in your underwear the entire movie. Now you put on jeans to walk to the kitchen after you just slept with this woman. Like, it makes no sense to me. Also, that whole scene is completely confounding because he refers to it as his house. And then she talks about it as if it's hers. And then he tells her to clean up when she's done as if it's his. And I don't know where they were.
I found them to be charming and I was certainly rooting for them. But he, the character, Turner, Scott Turner, mm-hmm. detective, acts real weird with this particular woman. He does not act like someone who is trying to woo her. And I think he is leaving town.
I do buy that he doesn't want to get attached
going
to her
that far.
Also, right? Can we discuss the job that's like the boost up for him, the next step in his big career? He's joining the California Highway Patrol.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
He's going to be a chip.
Mm-hmm. Can you see him on a motorcycle though? No.
This is part of why I kind of love this movie. Like, I love how
low stakes.
It's not even low stakes because, you know, you're investigating a murder, but it's small scale.
Yes.
You know, like, it's small scale. It's just a very, like, human-sized story if you take the dog out of it.
The small town of it, I appreciated. I think probably my favorite line in the whole thing is when he introduces himself to Mare and she says his name before he can. Yeah. And he looks at her and she's like, "We use the same bank." And I was just like, yeah. Okay, like, that's what? Adorable. That's sweet. That's endearing. Yeah. That's lovely. Yeah. Wonderful. But I mean, I love her and I've loved her since she was Wendy in St. Elmo's Fire. And
she's great. I'll say the other thing that made me really feel the small townness is at the very end when he opens up when his partner opens up the garage and he finds all the bicycles. He's like, "You cracked the bicycle thief ring thing."
There's also he steals that guy's car. He knows the kid's name, and he's like, "Why can't your mom, you know, get a car with muscle?
A muscle car."
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that too. I also love that the guy is Reginald Val Johnson. I love the idea that, like, last year he was probably, you know, with John McCain, like,
yep,
or John McClane, like outside Nakatomi Tower, and he's like, "I've had enough of this. I got to go somewhere easy."
Yeah.
I think that's so. I know it's so funny. I'm watching with my kid who has watched Die Hard, and he's like, "Is he always just like the cop?" And I'm like, "Yeah, always just a cop for whatever reason." He's like, "He doesn't look like a lot of cops. They're usually more fit." I'm like, you know, it was the 80s.
He was able to do some stuff.
He was able to jump over some fences. And he's such a wonderful, like, endearing best friend type character. I was going to ask you guys, did you by any chance watch Letterman's show where he does the hour-long interview with Chappelle?
Mm-mm. Yes, I did. Yeah.
How nice is that town Chappelle lives in?
Yeah, no, that sounds amazing. Just this.
I think it's called Yellow River, Ohio. It has the same vibe as this movie, where Chappelle grew up in this town. His dad was like a professor at the nearby college, and he's, you know, Dave's asking him, like, "Is there racism in this town?" He's like, "Well, you know, look, we're a liberal enclave, and I've lived here my whole life. I'm just Dave to everybody, you know." And that was I do think that, you know, it's a little more loaded when you're asking a black person that question in a small town. But I did feel like that was a sincere answer. Like, it just in a small town is different. You do know everyone. Like a real small town. Like, we're talking about 10,000 or less. Mm-hmm. You really do know everybody. It's kind of a lovely thing.
Yeah, this town felt very Stars Hollow-y to me a little bit, you know, of just that sort of everybody knows everybody. And it seemed, you know, cute. I mean, I'm going to give a brief synopsis for the people that haven't watched Turner and Hooch. Detective Scott Turner, played by Tom Hanks, is an uptight by-the-book police officer who hopes to leave his sleepy California town and work in the big city. When his friend Amos Reed, played by John McIntyre, the proprietor of a junkyard, is killed, Turner reluctantly inherits the man's dog, realizing that the canine may be able to help him solve the murder case. Turner attempts to adjust to life with the big dog, resulting in much household destruction and unwelcome chaos. As I mentioned, it was written by Dennis Shayak, Michael Blodgett, Daniel Petrie, Jim Cash, Jack Epps Jr., directed by Roger Spottersworth. Turner and Hooch opened on July 28th, 1989, in first place against Lethal Weapon 2, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, and Friday the 13th, Part 8.
Are we doing that, Phil?
That hurts my heart.
I don't think so. I don't watch horror movies.
It's Jason Takes Manhattan, right?
Maybe. If he takes Manhattan, maybe I'll do it. It would go on to make $71 million on a $13 million budget. It has 52% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 51% from audiences. Variety said the rather mechanical style of director Roger Spottersworth, who took over the film after original director Henry Winkler departed, fails to enliven the stereotypical criminal proceedings. And the New York Times said the one level on which this mild children's comedy works is as an extended gross joke for eight-year-olds.
I didn't even read that.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think this movie also, just to hopefully make your heart hurt a little bit less, Toby, I think that When Harry Met Sally was in its, if I'm not mistaken, its second or third week. Most of these films were in their second or third week of release or longer at this point. So they picked a window where this film could obviously capitalize. So
Phil, something we've been noticing in these 89 films that I think feels apparent with those snippets you read from the reviews is that people were tired of these types of movies. And you know, having just watched Beverly Hills Cop and then watched Beverly Hills Cop 2, like these are structurally the same movies, and structurally, thematically, almost tonally, yep. Kind of like this marriage of comedy, some kind of comedy, with the type of criminal plot you could find in almost any movie. Drug trafficking and people getting murdered and shootouts at the end. And I would imagine in 89, people were really tired of them, having lived them for about 7, 8, 9 years. I'm not, you know, I miss them dearly. Like I miss movies like this that lead with the story and follow with the comedy dearly, because we have years and years and years of movies like, for instance, Pineapple Express, which is the inverse of this, which leads with what's the funniest thing we can do at all times, and the story drags along. And I think that movie suffers because if you're not really buying what these characters are doing, it's very hard to go with them on the journey. So I mean, I think spoiler alert, I think Beverly Hills Cop is a masterpiece and the template, you know, from which all of these films are working. But I think this is a template that really works well. And the thing I really did like about it, and maybe this is just where my head is at or whatever, but like, it's good, clean fun. You know, like the humor is just like, it's good, clean fun. It's not, the gross out is vomit. It's not shit. You know, there's not a shit joke in this movie. It's not vomit. It's drool. It's not a shit joke in a movie about a dog, which is kind of amazing. If you think about it, it's not a piss joke about a movie about a dog, which is kind of amazing. It's just these two creatures getting to know each other and Hanks being like hilarious, charming, and winning throughout. I it's a weird thing to say because it's fucking Turner and Hooch, but I think I loved this movie.
I mean, I think that I also
just surrendered.
It's something that Kenny and I have both been, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, Toby, as well. Mm-hmm. You know, watching these 89. No. Watching these 89 films, they are so comfortable. They're so comfortable. Like they're not, they're just not yes, they might be overly simplistic. And yes, audiences are jaded now. And you can't tell a story that's this one-to-one and this straight a line and this sort of obvious, because audiences, I don't think to a certain degree, would put up with that. But watching these movies now, it's just they feel like a warm blanket of just they're to Kenny's point, they're not cynical, they're not angry. There's just something very endearing And I agree with you, Toby. It's not like great filmmaking and like it's bouncing all over the place. It clearly had some creative issues, but like, put me in a car with Turner and Hooch on a stakeout and I'm there. Like it's
embarrassing that we're admitting this.
I agree. It's embarrassing.
I agree too. I will say,
but you know what I'm saying a little bit of what I'm saying, Toby? I don't know.
Yes, I completely understand that. I would argue, and this is a weak argument because I can't think of an example right now, but I would argue there are other films that did this better.
Oh, for sure.
And
did what better? The cop buddy movie or like?
No, just like what you're saying, like a family friendly comedy that is endearing and non-offensive and, you know, pretty basic, but it works. I don't know. This just isn't like,
I mean, top Spielberg produced a lot of them in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? So there is things of, you know, Goonies comes to mind to a certain degree, or just family
Goonies
fun.
Goonies is so covers. Different than this, though.
Yeah, like, no, totally, totally.
And the one top of my head that, you know, we're going to cover very soon that's basically flawless is True Beverly Hills. But like movies. You agree?
Toby likes True Beverly Hills, guys. Yeah. Based on the reaction,
I was waiting to bring up the Craig T. Nelson thing. Yeah,
of course.
How do I get on that episode?
you mean Freddie? I've seen that movie so many fucking times, and it's a tremendous movie, and it does
own that movie. Wonderful. I watch it. It's all the time. It's
so good.
I mean, can we just talk about that from now on?
But we can talk about it a little bit because we haven't done it yet, but it is good, clean, fun, and mm-hmm. I love that. But it's also, you know, it's more of explicitly a not so much a kids movie, but like a tween movie,
mm-hmm.
right? Like it is made for like 10, 11, 12-year-olds, you know, a lot in the same way that Clueless is kind of made for like 13, 14-year-olds, but works really well for everybody ever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there are, of course there are movies, Toby, that you're right, that are family friendly. I would say Big falls on that list. I would say League of Their Own falls on that list.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I just because it doesn't, you know, live up to those standards, which it doesn't. I don't know. I guess I just kind of felt like, was it even trying to be like great, or was it just trying to be that movie you watch in July to get into the air conditioned theater? You come out at 8 o'clock and it's still like twilight, and you know, mm-hmm. you stop by you get a crab roll and you I don't eat crab rolls, but you
because they have mayonnaise. Yeah.
Yeah. It's disgusting. And you go hang out on the paddle boat. Is that,
but do you think that
I want to kind of with paddle boats? Yes.
Uh-huh. It feels like a New England night or a Pacific Northwest night, which is kind of like the most like warm, lovely moment I can think of. And I put myself in.
I think that this film also, it should be said, you know, this is Touchstone Pictures, you know, 1989. Katzenberg and Eisner have just taken over Disney. They're trying to recalibrate. They're trying to figure out how to sort of, you know, get Disney back to its glory, if you will. And you know, when I saw that Touchstone fanfare logo show up, I did kind of have this moment where I was like, I do miss this breed of movie, of sort of the family movie, the live action Disney film that has a little bit of edge to it. It's just a little bit, you know what I mean? It's not being a full on Disney movie, you know, when they were quote unquote afraid to put Disney's banner on a movie, but they produced it and developed it. And I think that this film does kind of speak to that. It's probably not even in my, I don't know, maybe my top 10 Touchstone movies. I'm sure I could name a bunch more that I liked. True Beverly Hills, I think, is a Touchstone movie, if I'm not mistaken, as well. But I just think that it's an interesting moment in movies that we just don't really have anymore. So that was kind of, I think, a little bit of not even nostalgia, but just wishing that that lane existed still.
I miss Touchstone movies desperately.
Another Bruckheimer thing. A lot of Touchstone Hollywood Pictures. A lot of, I mean, he's been a Disney guy for a long time.
I keep in my head, I keep going back to the summer movie of it. And mm-hmm. like, I think another like family friendly one that I loved growing up was Summer Rental. And
sure,
it's completely lovely and also just kind of dumb, but like this movie is dopey in a way that I normally would not have issue with. Like, I'm the one who's always defending the movie that people are like, why do you know so much about this movie? Why do you watch that movie so much? Like,
right.
I'm that person. And for whatever reason, this just, I just don't connect with it, with the exception of like the scenes that belong in a rom-com. And it's not that I don't like action movies. It's not that I can't do a buddy cop film. It's not that I hate dogs, but you know what? I mean, it's none of those things. I just,
do you think that part of it was, and I feel like this is a good time to ask this question, which is, if a dog ID'd a person, would that hold up in a court of law? I mean, is that a thing that would, cause I think that part of, I gotta be honest, I bumped a little bit on the moment when he asks Mayor Whittingham if like the dog can actually like ID a person. And she's like, you know, that's not really how this works. Like, so at least he's able to laugh at the stupidity of this concept. But did that bump you? Did you find yourself conceptual? Okay.
Right. No, because I said that is the complete, that's the conceit of the movie. I just jump on board with that. So no, didn't bother me. And I think especially because she looked at him like, you're an idiot.
You're an idiot. Yeah. Sure. There were three other people apparently in consideration for this role: Jack Nicholson, Bill Murray, and Chevy Chase. I guess those all make sense. I mean, Bill Murray and Chevy Chase more so than Jack Nicholson.
Well, I mean, as good as it gets is him and a dog, right?
This killing is true.
Killing it.
That dog steals a lot of scenes from him. Yeah.
Jack Nicholson would have been great because of what you just said, Toby.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Murray, it actually seems like it was written for him. And it might have been like an actual classic with Bill Murray, because he would have played up the absurdity of it all more.
Yeah.
You know, there's like nothing better than the scene in Groundhog's Day when he actually drives with Phil, Punxsutawney Phil, off the cliff. Like,
don't never really, drive angry. Never drive angry.
Really knows how to speak to an animal.
Yeah.
It's funny because I was thinking about Chevy a lot today, because Fletch is like just, you know, half a step down from Beverly Hills Cop. A very small step. Fletch is a lot like this movie too.
And I've never seen Fletch.
Is an incredible film. Fletch is fucking funny. He is so fucking funny in it.
Fletch
and the
is the movie they always played when it was raining at camp.
Fletch is a Fletch for whatever reason is a movie that Jews love.
Can I just say that Toby said that is the most Toby thing ever.
There's a Jewish sensibility to that humor, like Dr. Rosenpien. It's like there's something about that like Jews feel seen.
I think because it's relentless.
That's right. It is relentless.
Yeah.
And it's so funny when you learn that like Chevy is like actually like, you know, a Mayflower and like fucking, you know, five generations of like American royalty or actual royalty. He's the least fucking Jewish guy in America.
No, but he has towns in Maryland named after them. That is for sure.
he chose the name.
I know.
Right? His real name, of course, is Cornelius. So, which is true. But okay. He would have done great, Chevy. Maybe 89, his rose was all, you know, the bloom was already off his rose a little bit. You know, we did Christmas Vacation already, but it did kind of feel like it was waning a bit for Chevy. I don't know. I maintain that Tom Hanks really did a good job. And to contrast, Jim Belushi did make a movie, like I think this year or the year before.
Three movies.
Called Canine.
Yeah.
Canine. Okay. Which is the exact same premise. And except the dog works for the police in that one. And those movies are not well regarded.
I wish you could have all seen Kenny roll his eyes at the dog works for the police. Like
the dog has a job.
Dog had to fucking work for the cops.
I'm sure he gets W-9s. I mean, this is ridiculous. I think that there are so many landmines with a movie like this. And if you don't have a top comedian who also is really good at playing the straight scenes, you will sink so fucking hard.
Can I ask this? Go ahead, Toby. Sorry.
Oh, no. I was just going kind of jumping further. Mm-hmm. The scene. Can I talk about the scene at the end?
Absolutely. Go. Yeah.
Are we worried about spoilers?
No, because I was going to ask a question about the end.
So okay. So ahead. The dog dies, right?
And what? Spoiler.
Yeah. Spoiler. Sorry. And the scene at the vet, you know, the dog gets hurt during the shootout and he runs over to his girlfriend, the vet, to save him. And that scene when they lose him is Tom is so much more compelling than he's any right to be in that scene. Like to me, that it almost bothered me how good he was in that scene because comparatively the rest of the movie is, it doesn't come close to that. You know what I mean? And so in some ways I almost think that Tom maybe was too good of an actor for a role like this. I don't know.
Well, I think that looking at his filmography, you get the distinct impression that he's sort of like, he's at a place where he got the Oscar nomination for Big, right? Like mm-hmm. that's obviously a big deal. So he wants to be taken seriously.
I would say that's a very unique type of Oscar nomination.
Sure.
You don't see very often.
Mm-hmm. For sure, so. For sure.
It's more of an endorsement to like welcome to the career. Mm-hmm.
But there's a push and pull, I think, to your point, Toby, of a guy who wants to be taken a little bit more seriously, is hoping that he's going to get sort of into that stratosphere of, I guess, a Robin Williams, where like, you know, you get out of the comedies and you're taken seriously as a dramatic actor. Mm-hmm. And then this lands on your plate and you're making this movie and sounds like it was a bumpy ride. And I imagine that must have been frustrating, but he shows up for that scene for sure. Mm-hmm. And my question here is, and Tom Hanks apparently in an interview years ago said that he thought the movie could have been more successful had Hooch not died. My question, right? Mm-hmm. I agree with you, Kenny. Like the dog has to die at the end. Like
it has he didn't have to die. Successful is a relative term, right? Like he didn't creatively, that was the right decision.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
It's called saving the cat, not the dog. Yeah.
They shot two endings. They tested both endings, and apparently it was like basically neck and neck. And Katzenberg said, let's go with the one that people were a little bit more passionate about, which was the end. You know, people just seemed a little more, you know, whatever the right word is. So they went with that ending. And to your point, Kenny, if the dog lives, I don't think this film has the same lasting power. Like, I think it's still the Tom Hanks dog movie under all circumstances. But I do think that if that dog lives, this movie is that much more of a throwaway.
I agree with that.
I think also, go ahead, Toby.
No, I was just going to say, who doesn't break up with the vet who kills the dog? I don't know.
Good point.
That's but she didn't point. Kill the dog. She just wasn't able to save the dog.
So, couple things. Lots of thoughts here.
Please.
One, I was very high on Hanks going into that that scene, so I have a very different feeling on this. I thought he was like making the movie at every moment. I thought he made a lot of really great decisions. You know, the character of the neat freak is usually a drag, and he did not make this character a drag. The character was still funny. He was still Tom Hanks in the workplace. The mailman came in and he'd go, stop police. Every time it was their shtick. He had shtick with guys. He was funny with Reginald Bell Johnson. He was ambitious. The whole thing was that he wanted to go, you know, take on a role that had more action. He was excited to take on the case of this murder. He also was the only person in town who hung out with this disgusting fucking junk man. And his disgusting.
Hey, Amos was lovely.
Amos was a sweet guy, Kenny.
Not mutually exclusive. Disgusting junk man who fed his dog beer and Miller beer at that, the banquet beer.
Disgusting junk man is a great movie though,
and also his disgusting dog, and he was the only person that this dog liked. So like, I don't think that the characterization was like particularly obvious. I think it was pretty hard to thread that needle to have a guy who can like get a hickey from a dog also be the guy who's meticulous about his fridge, but Tom Hanks threaded that needle. So after he pulled off that incredible death scene, just devastating, really set him up for the Jenny funeral stuff. in a much worse movie than this, I wrote in my notes, Tom Hanks should have been nominated for this movie.
Wait, nominated for what though?
the best actor in a feature film.
Wait, are you talking about an Oscar?
Oh, yeah. Yes. At the Academy Awards, also known as the Oscars, I thought that Tom Hanks should have been an Academy Award nominee for what he pulled off here. Because the other thing that I love that the fucking dog died. I'm sitting there with my daughter, dog obsessive. We have two dogs. One is chilling here right now. We had to put down a dog in their lives, like in their memories. So like since my little kid's born. So within the last 3.5 years, we put down a dog. And I was in the room. I know what it's like to have a fucking dog be put down in front of you. It is hard. And there is no other way to play that. It doesn't matter what the movie is. You have to play it like something you love is going away in front of you. Mm-hmm. And anything less than like full commitment to that moment would have killed this movie. So there's that. And then the other thing I was going to say was, I like it. I like it as a dad. I like that. It's like a safe place for my kids to kind of confront the idea of not everything is forever. And if this dog gets shot and limps away, I don't think you really get much out of that. It's the most perfect, but it's the most obvious, but most perfect ending that this dog winds up with little Hooch, just like with little Groot in fucking Guardian of the Galaxies. It's the same idea. It's a beautiful, like little ending of this movie. I was so happy to see it because I figured that's what happened because I remember that Hooch died because could not remember having seen it on the plane. That's a thing in pop culture that Hooch dies. You know that. You know that like Luke is your, you know, that fucking Darth Vader is Luke's father. But the end was
on par.
They're equal. They're equal reveals. But
they're brought up in conversation the same amount too.
They should be. But I think the end was like lovely and beautiful. And it's weird. I didn't really cry, but like.
I cry.
It doesn't mean anything. I'm not crying anymore. I'm like, I'm fucking beat to shit in the middle of a pandemic. You're dead inside. I did cry at the 8th episode of Ted Lasso, though. Oh, what do you have?
Also at the end of episode 5.
I haven't. I'm only on 8 right now. Which is 5, Toby?
With the wife.
That was devastating. That's when that movie. That's when that show turned. I the one I cried at, I think it was 8. Might have been 7. Was the panic attack.
Oh yep. My God! Yes.
Yeah, that guy. That fucking. Do you love that show?
Oh, it's.
I mean, it's a warm hug. Like it is, especially right now. But it gives me like Schitt's Creek feelings, and I just think it's.
Gives me Parks and Rec feelings. But
it's noble in a way that most shows aren't. I don't know.
Noble or notable?
Well, both. But I said noble.
It is noble. Mm-hmm. It is. My friend called it magnificent. I think it's a magnificent earnest, show.
In a lovely way, yeah.
I do think that I hear the Parks and Rec. I hear the Schitt's Creek, even though, you know, I'm 2 seasons into Schitt's Creek. I don't think I've gotten to, like, the parts that really do that to people.
Mm-hmm.
It has Touchstone movie vibes. It has, like, it's that is the closest thing to, the feelings I get and I want from particular movies that were made in the 80s and 90s. I'm crazy. I'm crazy about it. And I'm so set up to dislike it. I don't like soccer. I don't love Jason Sudeikis. I don't like shows based on stupid fucking one-off sketch characters. I don't like one of their fucking creators. I the premise is ripped from Major League. I really wanted to not like it. I love it so fucking deeply. It's my favorite show in years.
Mm-hmm.
Can I agree with everything you're saying. I think that I didn't love the pilot of Ted Lasso, if I'm being completely honest. It took about 3 episodes before I was like basically crying every episode for it to get its hooks in me and for him not to feel he felt a little sketchy, sketch comedy to me in the pilot. Like it felt like it hadn't earned its stripes yet. And then it really does very quickly, which is a credit to everybody involved. But it's the little moments, it's the little things, it's the relationship between Juno Temple and, forgive me, I can't remember the character's name.
You're talking about Roy?
Roy,
yeah.
You know that guy's a writer on the show?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Awesome, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's great. Like that little slow blossom of their relationship, I just like fell totally in love with Juno Temple. I liked her before this. I mean, but my God, she's just absolutely off the charts amazing in this show.
It's one of those shows and it's a bad thing that we do now. And I'm certainly one of the, you know, worst offenders in maybe the world that a show doesn't count unless it gets nominated for awards.
Yeah.
There's this thing where like a show, there's no like wire anymore where like you could, like people could just love the show even though it's not getting nominated. However.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
There should be 7 nominations from this show. There should 7 people should be getting nominated out of this show. At least.
The whole cast.
I mean, fucking Roy should be nominated and fucking Nate should be nominated. So that's how deep I'm going with it, right? I obviously think Juno Temple should be nominated. I think Sudeikis should win every award ever made. I think Rebecca should be fucking nominated. Yeah. Maybe not Coach Beard, but I love Coach Beard too. And I think that's a really great character.
Mm-hmm.
I love Sam. Mm-hmm. And I thought Jamie Tartt was great. Like, that was a great character.
Yeah.
And a great arc.
Mm-hmm.
It's a legitimately great show.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to mention about this.
Oh, no. Danny Rojas. Danny Rojas. What a show. All right.
so on the Turner and Hooch thing that I was going to mention is the little scenes are the ones that kind of pop for me the most. The scene where where Hooch has helped him move the case along and he gives him a bunch of chocolate chip cookies and a can of beer as like a present for being.
Who gives a dog chocolate?
Well, there's that. Yeah, they would kill the dog. But that okay. But it's Tom Hanks sitting down next to him, mm-hmm. noticing that the dog is melancholy, noticing that the dog misses his owner,
mm-hmm.
and scratching behind his ear, and just that like a wordless scene between the two, like that's the goods for me.
Yeah.
And listen, I'm a dog person, I get it, but it's also just like that's Tom Hanks finding ways to lock into the nuance of a movie that does not have much of it. So I appreciated those moments a lot.
You know, I didn't connect the dots until just now, but Tom has a dog and You've Got Mail, and Brinkley is very visible in the movie and he's playful with him. I mean, he doesn't solve any murders, but he...
He doesn't. Frankly, doesn't.
He does not. But he's lovely with that dog, and there are glimpses of that in that scene that you're talking about.
Well, and I mean, Tom Hanks has talked about the fact that, you know, in the death scene, the way that he got there was because he knew that he wasn't going to see the dog anymore, and that like this was the last time he was going to see the dog.
So like he was able to kind of like the actual dog, the dog actor, however, whatever you want to say,
the
like
spit he knew that, mill. Yes. I mean,
the, yeah, sure. He knew that this was the end of their, you know, their relationship.
Right.
And that got him to a place where he needed to go emotionally. Again, you know, Tom Hanks is great. We all know that Tom Hanks is great. And it's just an interesting, weird little bridge that we have for him in this sort of late 80s period where it's kind of weird for him, right? Like he just like, where does he fit in Hollywood? And it's amazing that he found a way to fit.
There are a lot of, comparisons made to Jimmy Stewart when it comes to Tom Hanks. Sure. And I think Jimmy Stewart would have fucking nailed this in a way that sure. I would have wanted to watch it again.
Sure. Sure. And that's fair. I think actually I saw an interview recently with Tom Hanks on, I think it was Colbert, and he was talking about how he met Jimmy Stewart once. And I'm just like, that must, like just those two guys together must have just been
unbelievable. I bet he met him more than once. Jimmy Stewart lived quite a long time.
He did.
You know, I mean, when you mentioned Jimmy Stewart, it does make me think there are other ways to have played this mm-hmm. and other people who would have been really kind of interesting in this role.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
The thing about this that I didn't remember that does kind of limit, I think, who you could cast in it, this particular the script, is that Turner is willing to take the dog in a way that I didn't remember, right? Like Turner accepted very quickly that if he didn't take this dog, there was no place for this dog to go. And also maybe he could help him solve the case, but that really wasn't at the forefront here. I think the obvious move, the worst move, would have been something really craven. Like, I need this dog because he can only, you know, only he can help me save this case, but I hate this dog, mm-hmm. right? Like, this dog is horrible. So that, because it wasn't that, you do need a guy who can sell that, which I don't really know any other way to put it. It's an obvious thing in real life because most people aren't like monsters who hate dogs. But in movies, there are a lot of monsters who hate dogs, like Jack Nicholson and, you know, As Good As It Gets. No one in real life would fucking throw a dog down a chute. If they did, they'd go to jail. But, you know, that's a pretty typical kind of like, you know, villainous or, you know, pre-arc movie character type move. So I do think that I think Turner's a really interesting kind of fully formed character in that way.
Which is what Tom's bringing to it. I mean, like, I think it we should say again, like, it's a pretty rote script, right? Like, this is paint by the numbers for the most part. They're not, but Tom is imbuing it with a three-dimensionality that actually makes Scott Turner into a real person.
But what I like about it is, okay, so you have a script that's pretty rote. Instead of connecting the dots with something wild and silly, which I think has been happening the last 20 years, mm-hmm. they're connecting the dots with kind of the most obvious and plain and terrestrial ideas here. You know, like why is Hooch staying with Turner? Because Turner is the cop who's on that beat and he treats him, you know, with like kindness. Like that is what would happen.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you were saying, you know, that conceptually this feels of a certain type of film at a certain time. And now we live in a world where this movie is being turned into a Disney Plus show, which, you know, I was reading about sort of what it's about, and it's more about like the military, and it's a military dog and like a whole host of things that I'm sort of like, sure. I don't really know how it's a television show, and maybe it'll be a hit. I don't know. But to me, what I like about it too is that it's
Josh Peck, by the way, has strong young Tom Hanks vibes.
He does. By the way, I'm not shitting on the show. I haven't seen a lick of it. I don't know. Mick G might direct the hell out of it, and it might be fantastic. I don't know.
right? But who knows?
Who knows? But it's just to your point, Kenny, that like we're in a time now where it's like a movie that is relatively simple, that's telling a simple story, just doesn't get made. I want to kind of jump through the plot a little bit here. As we mentioned, Tom Hanks is playing this character, Scott Turner, who is moving out of town. It's his last couple of days, and he is training his replacement. And they go to visit Amos, who's complaining about noise from the what would you call it? The like
fish seafood warehouse. Magnate? It's like a fish warehouse.
Yeah, the fish warehouse.
The local seafood magnate.
Who seems to be doing some suspicious... everyone, sure. Amos is killed. Turner's alerted to the crime scene. Craig T. Nelson, everyone's favorite coach, is there.
Not
as the
mine.
Not your favorite coach?
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm saying that like he... The show is named Coach. Our favorite coaches.
He is my favorite patriarch of a parenthood family.
There you go.
Sure, fine.
He's my favorite mother. Right?
Yes, there's better coaches. I didn't mean it literally, but yes. There are better fictional coaches, guys.
I love Craig T. Nelson. I love
him. He's in the Family Stone, too.
And he's great in True Beverly Hills when he's the Freddy.
Yeah, the Muffin Man.
He does something though in this which I think is interesting, which he immediately is the bad guy. Like he shows up and he's immediately suspicious, and at no point do you think that anyone else is the bad guy other than Craig T. Nelson.
You see him show up and you're like, oh, he must have a huge part, and no, he has two scenes, maybe three, and so yeah,
he does shoot a guy just like in the face with a shotgun at the end, which is fucking crazy. The end of this movie gets surprisingly violent.
Well, yes, it does. The other thing is all this talk, and like obviously this is not my desert island movie. This is not my Castaway. This is not even almost a movie that I love, but the dog is very, very good. At the end, it's crawling. How did they do that?
Literally at the end of the film, I was watching
one of the great K-9 performances ever.
It was fucking incredible. I was like, this guy's a legend.
Okay.
This is one of the best dog performances
but
ever.
Still, yes.
Guys, how about the face on that guy? That's a Walter Matthau of dogs right there. I mean,
another question. Now I need a K-9 odd couple.
Is Walter Matthau hot? I know that sounds like a silly question because, like, I think like he's clearly not hot, but I also think like
no, ugly has women become hot. Love him. Ugly has become hot.
You're getting at what I'm putting down.
Yeah.
Like
the short answer, no. But
of course not.
If you go back, if you like a young Walter Matthau, like he could kind of
get
it.
He's got a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
First of all, I love the way you read that line, Toby. That was great. like you really sold it. But yeah, that's a thing. It's my family is a weird family, and it's like my dad kind of looks like a cross between Walter Matthau and Harrison Ford. So on his good days, he's got some Ford.
Hearing or no hearing?
But you could try. But so on his good days, he's got a lot of Ford in him. On his bad days, he's got a lot of Matthau in him. So in my family, Walter Matthau's always kind of been like, this is another word to say about your own family, but almost like a covert sex symbol type thing. Like my mom's always been like, oh, that Walter Matthau. I mean, everyone loves Walter Matthau. But I think I've heard it from other people.
But you can even put like an Elliot Gould to a lesser degree. Like the people who aren't stereotypical matinee idols have
people loved Elliot Gould.
Oh, I still do. Yes.
Yeah.
But they have, in more recent years, those people, the people that, like, I don't know, you think of, like, character actors. I'm not talking about, like, Charles Durning, but, like, there are...
David Strathairn, for instance.
Well, no, he's very good.
That's a good-looking guy.
He's a good-looking guy, yeah.
But I just mean, my point here is, and I think I understand, because I'm watching these AFI movies for this AFI movie club with my friends, and, like, those 70s... Those 70s actors that were given, where you're just like, obviously Paul Newman and Robert Redford. I mean, they're beautiful men, but like your young Al Pacino, you're kind of your
oh,
young.
Oh, you're crazy, Phil. Al Pacino.
I just mean they're not matinee idol guys. These are guys who don't feel like they feel
only,
a little
he's five
bit
foot, 5 foot two, but you can move around
there. I buy this conversation. Hoffman.
Yes, Hoffman 100%. Though I don't know if Hoffman was ever like sex symbol-y. Maybe he was. I don't know.
A little bit in Tootsie.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen Tootsie?
Yeah, I think it's.
I haven't seen Tootsie. I think that's like, an AFI.
You're
going
to watch it for AFI, so you're going to watch it. I think Tootsie's as bad as
problematic.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, look, I came to Tootsie very late in life, so it may. I watched it, you know, maybe 10 years ago, but like I did not grow up with Tootsie. And Tootsie was one of the movies where I was just like, this? It was number two on the AFI comedy movies, right? And number one is Some Like It Hot. So, like, you know, it's not like they have bad taste, you know? Yeah.
That's super weird. Yeah. Oh, wait. Can I talk about the Terry Garr of it for a second?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. The best
Garr
part.
Is phenomenal in Tootsie. She's also fantastic in Mr. Mom, which is a forever favorite of mine that I just rewatched again. I've never seen it,
but because of your tweets, I have recorded it. I have it on my DVR. I'm looking forward to watching it.
Dude, let's discuss separately. Yes.
Can't wait.
Michael Keaton would have been great in this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Michael Keaton is in that pre-Batman stuff, incredible. Like, so good at Mr. Mom. Hanks and Keaton are very much the same energy and similar careers in their own kind of weird way. Not really. They kind of landed in the same spot.
Yeah, but only but now parallel you got
at this time.
Henry Winkler fired.
One of them starred with Henry Winkler in Night Shift, and the other one got him fired off of Turner and Hooch.
Phil knows that, you know, I think Hanks deep down might not be the great guy everyone thinks he is.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I really agree with that.
I love that theory.
Yeah, I have a spec for you to read.
Of course, sure. I do want to on the Hanks and this does connect to Keaton to some degree as well, because both of those guys do physical comedy incredibly well. Mm-hmm. Like there's a immense physicality to them, and there's the doggy door bit when Hooch is dragging him into the veterinary hospital, Again, Hanks fucking nails that stuff. I weirdly love The Money Pit. I don't think it's a particularly good movie. But Tom Hanks in that movie, there's a scene that's still just fucking... The scene when he gets stuck in the floor, in the rug, and he's just talking to himself and going completely crazy.
And doesn't he get lower and lower and lower?
She tries to pull him out, and then he just falls.
I don't think it's a terrible movie.
I don't think it's a terrible movie, but it's not a great movie.
We used to watch that with my grandmother all the time.
But like Tom Hanks is fucking, like that is Tom Hanks doing like Charlie Chaplin shit. Like he's just the physical comedy that he brings to that. And there's a little bit of it in this, as I mentioned, the doggy door and, you know, generally wrestling Hooch to the ground at certain times. But like, do you sort of know what I'm saying? That like Tom Hanks doesn't do that anymore. Woody does that now, and that's all fine and good. But like it's
both these dudes got out. Hanks and Keaton got out at the right time.
Oh, sure.
This brand of comedy, this physical thing, this, you know, this like better looking than most comedian thing, better shape than most comedian thing. It ends at some point and you got to go, you know, it's time to go and see if you can hang with the big boys and, you know, open big movies or whatever. And it took Keaton a lot longer to get there because he kind of grew into himself. But I appreciate that. If he was still making Flubber in like, you know, the mid 90s, that would be very sad.
Yeah, I enjoyed the way you said Flubber with disdain. That's just beautiful.
Because Robin Williams still, there was a lot of money to be made, I guess. And he was a big brand. And I guess he felt like he had to make stupid ass movies like Flubber and Jack. But, you know, he didn't.
Wasn't Flubber a remake of a Fred McMurray?
I was going to say Jerry Lewis.
I'm thinking the Shaggy Detective. What's that called?
The Shaggy Dog?
Something Detective.
You're talking about the Tim Allen Shaggy Dog remake?
Absent-minded Professor
is Flubber. Yeah, that's Jerry Lewis.
Please hold.
But that's what it is. Absent-minded professor is flubber, and you know, nutty professor is nutty professor.
So absent-minded professor is what's his nuts? It's Fred McMurray. It's Fred McMurray.
Amazing.
Wow. Okay.
That guy had three. That guy had three pretty distinct careers.
Oh my God! I mean, so that was my point. Is that he started off as just like a really like good actor. I mean, he had incredible parts, everything from The Apartment to Double Indemnity. And then he kind of steered into this wholesome family area.
Yeah, TV Dad. Yeah.
And then TV Dad. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that, you know, there's dignity in that. I think like, you know, that's how you belong to your career. What's that?
He was also in The Shaggy Dog.
Did he turn into a dog?
Yeah, he's a lawyer who turns into a dog.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the lawyer turned into a dog.
How do we feel about Hooch's relationship with Camille? I liked the Lady and the Tramp kind of vibe that they had.
But I got a kick out of the fact that it's like the lady vet with her lady dog and like the cop with his hard, you know, boy dog. Like that, I liked that more than I should have.
I think it was a little underdeveloped.
I don't disagree with either of you. I think that I enjoyed it, but it's what it is. I want to just talk about the Scott and Emily storyline for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Because, first of all, I think both of them make it better than it probably has any reason to be or any right to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that the painting scene, what I thought was interesting. So she invites him in to help her with like some sort of a fuse box, something, I don't remember what it was. Anyway, he walks in and he sees that she's painted half of this room and she's going to bed. And he's like, I'm going to finish this because I can't deal with it being half done, which feels like some OCD behavior, which is fine. I mean, I suffer from OCD to a certain degree, but I thought it was just interesting that he was sort of like, yeah, you can go to bed. That's fine. I have to finish this. And then they have this really nice scene where she talks about, you know, wanting to get married and have kids. And he's like, well, good luck in this town. And you know, they have a nice scene together. I bought their chemistry. I bought the two of them together. I weirdly, as I was watching their first scene together, it occurred to me that I actually wrote a pilot that had a female veterinarian character. And I think in some way it was actually inspired by this, having seen this movie so many times as a kid. There's something very sort of lovely about a small town vet. Like she's just adorable and sweet and heartfelt. And
that's Sam Shepard and Baby Boom. Yeah.
I've never seen Baby Boom.
It shows. I don't even know.
Did you say that?
I said it shows.
I said I haven't seen Baby Boom, and she says it shows.
That's funny.
So anyway,
I think you would enjoy it, Phil. It's very endearing.
I fully intend on watching it. I should have seen it by now.
But it's another small town vet.
Yes, fair enough.
It also gave me some Doc Hollywood vibes. A movie that I've seen.
Yes. Yeah.
So many times. Like
good movie.
I know like every fucking beat of that movie. I love that movie. It's a great flick. But she wasn't a vet. I just looked it up. She was an ambulance driver. So you know, she was in healthcare one way or another, but it's had a very similar vibe.
Yeah. But you know, listen, we're not gonna go beat to beat through this crime story because it's pretty dumb. But the moment that I loved was when Scott takes Hooch to the fish factory and makes him smell one of the bags. And then Hooch like runs around and finds the bags because of the scent and whatever. It just feels like such a like,
that wasn't
is this what the TV show is going to be? Like this dog? Like, what are we doing here, guys?
Yeah, but anyway. I hated that. I hated that he had him smell like, I think what was in the bags, drugs. I don't even remember.
Money. They put money in giant ice cubes.
They had him smell money and he came back with the bag. That did feel quite lazy to me. But
there's a lot of lazy stuff in this movie from a crime solving perspective.
From a canine crime solving perspective. Yeah. The dog leans out the window and smells the perp across the street.
Yeah.
Dogs have great senses of smell. That I bought. what does it mean that dogs don't see in two dimensions?
When I don't know what you mean by what does it mean.
This is a dimension and that's a dimension, right? You can only see what I was pointing at if you get the Patreon. But this is a dimension and that's a dimension.
Sure.
Third dimension, I guess I could see them seeing like flat canvases, but you have to see two dimensions, right?
Well, what's weird about this thing is that there was a theory that dogs can only see in essentially that dogs can't see like a picture on a piece of paper, for instance. Like they can't actually see that, I guess. But many dogs I've had see on television all the time. So I don't really get it, unless maybe they're hearing it, but it seems very strange to me. So I don't know if that has been myth busted at this point or debunked. Yeah. But yeah, so Hooch is very helpful. He helps them solve the case. I mean, I mean,
helpful. I love that. That's it. That's kind of the perfect way to sum this up. Like, it's not about the crime story. The fact that it was taken seriously was enough for me. I don't remember any beats, but I didn't even remember if it was drugs or money. I thought they were like nice little things. Tom Hanks basically saying, you know, two weird things have ever happened in this town. $8,000 washes up on the beach and a guy is killed, probably connected. These little things were enough for me. It takes, you know, it ends with a shootout in a warehouse, which is where all these kind of movies end.
Fish warehouses, yes.
A fish warehouse, fish. Generally. Yeah.
Fish warehouse. And the, you know, the big bad was ultimately the, you know, the cop, which was something that any idiot would figure out from the moment they saw it, including my children.
I do think that you really can kind of suss out the level of crime action in this movie by the fact that a car chase ends at a fork in the road. Like, they're chasing a car goes one way, they go the other way, we lost them.
You know what I really loved? I really loved when they finally got Hooch under control that first time and Hooch is walking home next to the police car.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the moment where I'm like, oh, this movie's playing on another level, guys.
Can I also say, when Hooch destroys his house, I did think to myself, I mean, this dog, we're done. Like, if I came home and this dog, the moment that for me was when he destroys his fucking speakers, like, the dog is malicious, it feels like, in terms of what he's trying to do to his house. It's pretty insane, but you know, he gets over it. And it's fine.
I thought that the dog was just kind of a copycat. Like, it's like when he was in the kitchen getting drunk, that's E.T. Like, there's so much of like the E.T. alone in the house vibe. Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of E.T. in it.
I mean, they wish, but yeah.
Oh, snap.
There's also the fact that the dog, that Hooch is able to use his head to bust through a door.
That was insane that they let him do that. Do you know there was a stunt dog? There were two dogs that were Hooch, and then there was a third that was a stunt dog. I want to say his name was Ivan.
Dog?
This is a
just a headbutt dog, a dog that would just run into.
I don't know. They had a stunt dog, but the other thing that I forgot to tell you guys, which I should have just like opened with.
No, please.
So Roger, the director, second director guy, Spillane.
Spottiswood.
Yeah, Spottiswood. Sure. Yeah.
British
name.
He was. I watched a video interview of his. Then he was like. He was speaking with the equivalent of, like, to go back to rom-coms in Notting Hill. He was basically speaking to Horse and Hound. Like, he was talking about this movie to some canine, whatever. I don't know. But he tells us that Hooch had in his contract that he would fly on a Learjet to do press. And he did.
How could you not love this actor? How can you not love this dog?
Was this Hooch's first role? The balls on this guy.
But he understands.
This wasn't Marcel the Monkey.
Oh, God, no.
He's number two on the call sheet, Kenny. Come on.
What? Yeah,
I need to know where Mare was compared to
Hooch. Dogs aren't on call sheets. I know, because my dog was in an episode of Entourage. So there you go.
Give me the plot points real quick.
That my dog was?
Yeah.
Oh, this is all right. This is the truth is, my dog, we had just gotten him. So he was like a year old, and the plot points are Ari is trying to woo. Oh, this is crazy. Ari is trying to woo Jessica Simpson as a client, right? Does sure, anybody remember that Jessica Simpson's dog was eaten by a coyote?
Yes.
And she had no dog. Yep. So Ari uses my dog as a gift to give to Jessica Simpson, who's in the episode and accepts the dog as a gift for her to sign. That's real.
What a show.
Made $500. We still get residuals to this day.
That's just amazing. Kidding.
You don't get dog residuals.
No, wait, dogs aren't on the call sheet. Dogs don't get residuals. Dogs don't get residuals. Dogs they should get a union. What the fuck?
But they do get a special handler. They do get a trailer. That's true. He really got taken care of nicely.
That's
they fantastic. Get like, they get the dog. They get you have to have a dog guy. Come on set, hang out with the dog all day, make sure the dog's ready to go. And it was great. It was really a great moment for my dog. Probably the highlight of his life.
Do we want to rate this?
Yeah.
I'll go first. As I mentioned, I saw this in 89 and I really did like it as a kid. I think I probably would have given it an 80 back in 89. I think that I watched it more times than I clearly remember. And it brought back a lot of very nice memories watching it again. That being said, I see some more flaws in this film today than I did when I was 9 or 10. So it's down to like I'm at a 70 now. I think that, you know, I enjoyed this film. I don't know that I would watch it again anytime soon. But there's enough in it that I liked it's a good movie. It's a sweet, nice movie. I don't know.
You will never watch this movie again.
Okay. That seemed like a threat, but okay.
Toby, what do you got?
Yeah. Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. I saw this in the theater when I was younger. I was very enthusiastic in general with film back then, and so I probably would have been like 85 or something super, super dumb. After watching it and then after this discussion, you guys made me realize a few things about how truly endearing it is at moments, but I'm still at like a 43.
Wow, you wouldn't recommend this movie?
Well, who am I talking to? Am I talking to like puppies that want to become detectives? Sure, watch it.
Well, 50 is our general threshold in the sense that we say if you give it over a 50, that means you would recommend it to somebody.
I would recommend this as a family movie, but it wouldn't be top of my list. No, you know what? No, I wouldn't recommend it.
That's fair.
I wouldn't. Mm-mm.
Hey, you got to live your truth. Which I'm about to do as well.
You want to live my truth?
I'm going to live my truth. As aforementioned, I saw this film on an airplane. The experience stuck with me to some extent. It was a very negative experience. I thought this was a very, very stupid movie and a blight on society. I would have given it about a 19. Like, really, I really thought this was like a horrible, horrible like movie, like the kind of thing that like I wish never got made.
Okay.
I'm going to be like, give it something really stupid, like an 84, which is what I gave it. I give this movie an 84. I think it is awesome. I loved this movie. We've now done enough movies. We've done a lot of movies on this podcast.
We have.
Over 200 almost, right?
Over 200 for sure.
Yeah. So we have some lovely person named Keith Allison who puts it on a letterbox for us. And now I think about where it's going to be on my letterbox, like what it's going to be around. And 84 is where I put movies like this that I like truly enjoyed and like parts of me really loved and like anything I didn't like about it, like just washed over me because it doesn't matter. My kids liked it. We've enjoyed our experience with it. I'm shocked to say this, but Turner and Hooch is a great film.
I love this for you. I really do. I think you need this in your life. I think this elevates a side of you that we don't always see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I'm happy that it's
afraid you're going to say that I was deranged, but big deal.
For that
if I am, I am. Yeah.
but I also think like what I love is that a film that truly repulsed you.
Yeah, it did. It repulsed me.
Has turned, like, that's a corner to turn. That a movie could be so repellent to you and then now be something that you love.
The weirdest thing, I swear to God, I only gave it the time of day. Not because of the podcast, you know, we're watching the movies, but opened my mind to it because I thought you liked it, Toby. and had Phil been like, Toby wants to come on and shit all over this movie, I wonder how I would have viewed it. But like, I was very open. I was very open-minded, open-hearted, like generous. And it's interesting when you watch a movie like that. Like, I was watching a movie crafting arguments that would, that I thought would like play in concert with what you were doing. I like this movie because of this. Like, we like this movie together. And it's interesting when going into a movie like that. Maybe I should watch all movies, assuming Toby likes them.
I was going to say, it would be amazing.
The extent of my power knows no bounds.
But I will say, yes, sir.
I was just going to say, like, if you actually want to do that, if you want to watch the movies that you think I will like but nobody else on earth likes, I got a long list of ones that are a hell of a lot better than this.
Give me a movie. You know, you said a couple, but you said Leap Year, and I know Troop Beverly Hills. And give me a movie that you think is actually a great movie that has either a negative cultural reputation or a neutral cultural reputation, or is just altogether forgotten.
Okay. Now?
Yeah
you got to do it right now.
Yeah.
So the one that comes to mind, is it a great movie though? The one that comes to mind is the 1992 Melanie Griffith, Michael Douglas, Liam Neeson drama Shining Through.
Sure.
Whoa.
I love this movie. My sister and I watch this movie like we're like it's our life source. Like, I can't even begin to tell you how much I love this movie. And I don't know that it's great. I don't think it's horrible. I think it is a product of like the time and place when it was born. Sure. But most people have never heard of it, never mind seen it.
I've heard of it. I have not. I can see the poster in my mind's eye, but I've never seen the film.
So basically, the short version is World War II. Michael Douglas is a spy. We don't know that, but he is. He hires Melanie Griffith as a secretary, and she basically ends up having to go be a spy. And in Europe. And I am really not selling this movie at all. It's
this is what you get on the from the paywall, guys.
I think you would get it out stuff. Of it, Kenny, instead of like it just because it's like there are parts of it, like it's so 90s. Like there's just parts of it where you're like, really?
It's my shit.
But then you're on board, yes. And I really wish I had like rehearsed this part because my plea for this is so genuine, but it's so fraught right now.
Phil, do you have an answer to this?
Oh boy. Do I have a film that I love that is sort of maligned? Is that sort of, or like,
yeah, something that like, you know,
your feelings aren't at the same level as the world's feelings, basically.
And I think Shining Through sounds like a perfect example because it's not that fun for me if you pick something that like has its defenders, that has a cult.
Sure.
You know? Something that we're, you know, like, because I'll tell you what I'm thinking. And actually, I don't know if this fits into the category.
I have but one, but you go first.
Movie I've watched 100,000 times that I absolutely love, know every single line, that I think people think is kind of nothing, or they don't even know it, or they don't care, is Summer School with Mark Harmon. Like, I fucking love that movie. I think the characters are so well drawn. I think the conflict is so clear. I think the relationships are so cool. I think Mark Harmon, you know, Mr. Shoup is so fucking awesome. But like, I think people just think it's like off-brand, lame-ass, John Hughes knockoff, 90s, like pre-Bill and Ted shit with no one in it.
It's an Adam Sandler movie without Adam Sandler is what people think. I think. Yeah.
But
I'm a big Mark Harmon person. Stealing Home is like very pivotal in my life.
I used to watch that for like Worth Winning too, that he was in. Like, there's I mean, Kevin Costner probably is like my all time favorite actor. And Mark Harmon was almost to me like Kevin Costner's little brother. Like, yeah, he did a lot of the same things for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that my answer is totally right, but I'm going to say it anyway. This is a movie that I feel like a lot of people really, really hate. And I think there are a lot of problems with this movie, just to be above board. But for whatever reason, I find it very watchable. Elizabethtown is a movie that...
That's bold. I like that answer.
I mean, I'm a Cameron Crowe, like, fanatic.
Yeah, which is sort of why it kind of... Like, I'm an apologist for this movie because of what I think it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it is what it could have been.
Agreed.
But I also think that the phone call at the center of the movie... Where, you know, which is like a good like 10 minute scene of them just like talking to each other on the phone. The movie's fraught with problems. And yet for whatever reason, it kind of hits me in a way that I don't totally hate it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my pick for, you know, movie that people hate that I would.
People really do hate that movie. And yeah. I think writing really for that movie is pretty fucking brave, Phil.
I'm hoping to go on. It had Oscar buzz for that one. That feels like the
definitely had Oscar buzz.
I think that would be fun to do. But Toby, we're gonna have you back in a couple weeks. On a 99er. Mm. She's coming on for Liberty Heights.
Oh, nice.
So I'm excited about that because Kenny, you've seen the four.
I've seen
Baltimore
three
movies, right?
Not Liberty
Tin Men.
Okay.
I've seen the other three.
I have never seen Tin Men, so I'm looking forward to watching that.
I quite love them. I think I Barry Levinson's not my number one guy.
Made some great movies.
But I love that he basically made four movies about his childhood the way like Philip Roth wrote all these books about like growing up Jewish in America. It just has that same kind of like for me vibe. And those are my favorite, like Barry Levinson.
And movies. And who else could we bring on for perhaps the most Jewish movie? But you know, our resident.
Second most. Yeah. Jacob the Liar is the most Jewish.
Yeah, that's probably the most Jewish.
Yeah, I don't want to do that one, guys.
maybe we could talk about it in this episode and then be done with it. Could we like?
I just don't want to.
You want to do 5 minutes on Jacob the Liar inside the Liberty Heights episode?
No, we're doing it. Maybe we'll even like it.
You know what, Kenny? Toby loves it.
Toby loves it.
That's the new mantra. I'm going to text you every time before we do a movie that you haven't seen. Toby loves it.
No, it's. I just didn't like the idea of arguing with you, and lo and behold, like we didn't wind up arguing, of course, but lo and behold, like we did wind up. I'm not above arguing. I love to argue, but like
you're gonna lose.
That's right. I just don't want to be humiliated on Patreon Radio.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm excited to talk about the Baltimore movies with you, Toby, mm-hmm. the Barry Levinson four Baltimore movies. I haven't seen Liberty Heights since 99. I remember liking it fine, but it didn't leave much of an impression. So I'm curious as to how it holds up.
I've never seen it.
And I'm excited to, I don't know about you, Kenny, but once we're out of our Bruckheimer movies, when we're on the other side of that, I do want to watch I'm going to definitely watch Tin Men and Avalon.
I'm going to watch all four again too. I mean, I remember watching, I remember running them like the year I moved out here. So we're talking, you know, 16 years ago.
I mean, I saw Diner, I want to say within the last probably 6 to 8 months, and loved it. So I'm excited to keep going, and I haven't seen Avalon in a million years.
I think I have the closest connection to Avalon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to talk Levinson and talk about being Jewish in Baltimore, and it's gonna be great.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But thank you for being here, Toby, and talking about your favorite cop and dog movie. I mean, it's your favorite cop and dog movie, right?
I would have to do some research.
She's combing her brain trying to think of one other one so this doesn't have to be the favorite.
I don't know. I'd have to revisit K-9, and I'm sure there's some like subplot in one of the Beethoven movies where there's a crime.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, Toby. You're apologize.
Right. That's what Beethoven's about. I'm not kidding.
What about Clifford the Big Red Dog?
You know?
Yeah.
No crime.
No crime.
I love Charles Gordon. Okay. Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you for being here.
You know, it's funny you should say that because I didn't bring it up. Midnight Run is this. It's a very similar vibe to
it
me.
Really is.
I mean, Midnight really Run is the perfect 80s movie.
We're
and the perfect
get death threats.
From our 50 Patreon subscribers?
You're going to get death threats from people. I mean, people love Midnight Run, dude.
Oh, I just said it's the perfect 80s movie and the perfect buddy cop movie, even though neither one of them is a cop. But I love Midnight Run. That's mm-hmm. my point. But the it set up the paradigm of these, you know, the mismatched buddies who aren't like partners, like Lethal Weapon. And that's what they're playing on here.
So who's Turner and who's Hooch?
I mean, obviously Grover is Turner.
Turner's De Niro. I mean, Turner's the one trying to get the job done. And
no, but the uptight guy.
Yeah, but the uptight one
is doesn't matter if he's uptight. He's the wild card. Have you not seen this movie? He's the wild.
I saw it for the first time, like I don't know, 3 months
it's
ago.
It's the best. Now I'm on this Martin Brest, but like it's the best. And like Grodin is the best in that movie because he is this uptight accountant who's a total. Yeah, he's so smart. But he's a total fucking wild card. It's an awesome flick.
My favorite.
I loved it.
Charles Grodin performance, and I'm sure the three people who are listening have already tuned out, so I can say this with confidence. Have you ever seen Heart and Souls?
I thought you were going to say that, and I like Heart and Souls.
So
I loved that movie as a kid.
Lovely in that movie.
I thought you were going to say Clifford. I was going to run through the wall.
Wait, he did Clifford and Beethoven?
Clifford with Martin Short.
Clifford is not Clifford the Big Red Dog. It's Clifford the.
The big
boy man?
13-year-old. Yeah. Martin Short plays a 13-year-old. A movie I despise, and you want to know what? I might go Turner and Hooch on it if we watch it again. I might turn it around.
Yeah, but Toby does not love that one.
Well, I'll tell you, like Martin Short as a 13-year-old boy is the stuff of nightmares for me personally. But people like that. There are people. Ben Hosley loves it.
Ben Hosley loves it, but yeah,
who's
that makes
Ben
sense.
Guy?
Ben Hosley runs a Blank Check. He's a podcast. He's their
kidding.
Producer.
He's a podcast producer on another podcast that we have great affinity and respect for.
He was a past and hopefully future guest.
And he was a guest.
He
on
came
the show,
on
yeah.
for your favorite movie, Kenny and Julian Donkey,
Donkey
Boy.
Boy. I was thinking about him today because now I'm really going off. But so Ben Hosley, I think we told the story on the podcast, so we're not telling tales out of school, but Ben Hosley.
The best.
Phil and I were both in New York for a weekend, so we booked a couple of shows in New York, and we were using Ben Hosley's studio because he ran this studio. He's a pretty prominent podcast guy, but he's also, you know, he's also like, you know, like kind of a wild card lunatic from like rural New Jersey who like is trying to start a jean brand where he buries jeans in dirt and digs them up 5 years later. And sells
he's
them.
Literally doing that, Toby.
Called Buried Denim. He's a wonderful guy. I love him. So,
super nice guy.
So we set this podcast up. We did three in a row. And Ben Hosley shows up to his own podcast studio, which is locked. It's a Saturday. So we're sitting outside by the elevator banks with our other guest, Karen Hahn, who I think was on, 2 weeks ago. And he shows up and he goes, "I'm sorry. I'm a monster man. I'm a donkey boy."
Donkey boy.
We called him Donkey Boy. We're doing it. I thought he was wonderful.
It was great.
I was
Here's
so
what's great. I want to just say this, though, for a little bit of context, Toby. We get there. We're sitting in the hallway. It's Saturday. We're sitting outside a locked office. I get a text message from Ben where he's like, "Oh, shit. I forgot. I'll be there in an hour."
Yeah. Okay. With Karen Hahn, who neither of us had ever met.
Never met before. And sat in the hallway. By the way, lovely spending an hour with Karen Hahn. She Amazing. Was the best. It could not have been better. And then we ultimately, we were going to do three episodes and we kind of jammed Fantasia 2000 and Julian Donkey Boy into one episode. David Sims shows up to do his episode.
All right. It's the best. Anyway. We got to roll. I could tell Toby, if Toby's losing interest on the podcast she's on, the listeners are probably like, couldn't be more out.
Listen, guys, Toby, you're the best. We can't wait to have you back on in a couple of weeks to talk about Liberty Heights.
Thank it's you, guys. Great.
And
it's always
we really, really love you for coming on to talk about Turner and Hooch with us.
Well, it's my favorite, of course.
Hey, thank you for biting the bullet.
Thank you guys so much.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.